Hi, everybody. My name is Nancy Morris, and I'm an alcoholic. Hello. And I want to thank Jill and the committee for inviting me to speak here. I truly feel that it's a privilege and a blessing to be able to share my experience, strength, and hope, and especially at something like this. I feel that sometimes I tend to be flip, and I don't want to be. I truly feel it in my heart, maybe more so because yesterday I turned 31 years sober. I don't know, so I was reflecting on when I was new, but it truly is a privilege, and I feel completely blessed to still be here after 31 years, one day at a time, that's all it is. And I don't really think that I've learned many new things after the first 6 months of being here. It's pretty basic, it's pretty simple, and it's all just loving each other, one alcoholic speaking to another alcoholic. We have an understanding for each other that nobody else has. We can help each other where nobody else can. And I've gotten plenty of help over the years. To this day, I do. 31 years is just a lot of one day at a time for me. I'm still an alcoholic. I still have all those feelings inside of me that I've had my whole life. And I can just deal with them sometimes better now than I could before. But 31 years ago, I can still picture myself, or from my husband's vantage point, I was face down on a blue shag carpeting in this spinata throw up. And I drank a half gallon of spinata wine that night. I remember it was $1.65. It's red and fruity for, I don't even know if they have it anymore, but I had been sober for 4.5 months when I drank that. 4.5 months prior to that, I found Alcoholics Anonymous. I truly wanted to be sober. I did not ever think I would drink again. When I found Alcoholics Anonymous in January of 1971, and when I did drink again, I was pretty shocked. And to this day, I don't say that I will never drink again. I had a very good friend of mine who drank a few years ago, who had over 30 years of sobriety. She was the woman that many of us in my group in California where I got sober, she was the woman that we all looked up to. She was the one who sponsored many of the women, and she was active for years and years and years. And I don't really know what happened, but I know that she drank after 30 years of sobriety. So I don't say that I won't drink again. I have to keep myself in order and spit if you want to. It's okay. I don't care. But if they told me to spit, I'd spit. So I have to keep myself fit spiritually. And I do continue to go to meetings. And I have always gone to meetings. And I love to go to meetings. Why wouldn't I want to go to meetings? I have so many people in my life. I know there are a lot of newer people here and people that aren't so new, but I love having new people in my life. I love seeing them come to life and seeing them change and grow and see some hope in their eyes. And so I've been very, very blessed. I have so many beautiful people in my life that I want to go to the meetings and I want to be a part of this. I've never felt better in my life, and it's exciting for me to go to my meeting. So it's just something that I do. And I've been given the gift of sponsoring people, being a part of their sobriety. And I didn't ever say that's what I want to do. I had pretty tough sponsorship along the way. And when I was new, my sponsor said, go talk to that new lady who just walked in the door. And I said, I can't talk to her. I don't know anything, for one thing, but she was very pretty, and she was very well-dressed. And I did not think that that very pretty, well-dressed woman would want me to talk to her. And because I didn't, that's how I felt. I mean, I always, my whole life growing up, had these feelings of inadequacy, and I felt less than everybody else. I had no self-worth. I didn't feel important. I felt invisible a lot of the time. And actually, I don't really know that I even knew about those feelings or thoughts until I got sober. I really wasn't tuned into much of anything until I got sober. I just grew up with those feelings. That's the way that I was. And I think that for me, I just adjusted my life accordingly. And I found ways to get by in life with those feelings, either the way I acted and then with alcohol also. And I just drank. From the time I was a young teenager, I just drank. I don't remember picking up my first drink and saying, I feel inadequate and I'm going to drink this alcohol and then I'm going to feel better. That never occurred to me. I just simply drank. And in my case, I do have come from a family of alcoholics. I have 5 brothers who are alcoholic, a sister who's alcoholic, and my father died of alcoholism when I was new in the program. My mother is a professional martyr. She went to one Al-Anon meeting that I know of, and I think she thought she could go there and talk about all of us and how bad it was, and that didn't happen. I think she found out she had to look at herself, and she never went back. And my mother is still alive, and she's still the same way. I've come to accept her over the years and to know that she absolutely did the best she can and that she's doing the best she can now. But when my father died of alcoholism, when I was brand new in AA, after he was gone for a while, my mother started dating a man that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a man that came in and out of our meetings all the time, drunk. He would call people, he would burn down his house, he would fall off his bike, he would get hit by cars. Now, my mother constantly complained about my father's drinking, but yet this is the first man she started dating. She didn't meet him in an AA meeting because she didn't go to AA. I truly believe the guy fell off his bike in front of her car, and she had to stop and hook up with this guy because that's how she is. And she dated him for a number of years until he finally got sober and stayed sober, and then she couldn't date him anymore. And then she married this jerky guy who she's still married to, but you know what, she's happy and all is well there. But I grew up in this family, and with all that drinking going on, I remember one time I went into the kitchen, and I was probably 14 years old, and I snuck in the kitchen, nobody was around, and I got this big bottle of vodka down out of the cupboard, and I took the top off and I took a big drink of it, and it was pure water because that's the way it was in my family. Somebody beat me to it. So we had a built-in beer keg in an extra refrigerator that we had, and on the weekend or during the week I would save up big mayonnaise jars, empty jars, so I could fill them with beer when nobody was around, hide them in my closet, get as much as I could when it was still full, this beer keg, and then when I would hear my father yelling about how quickly that beer keg emptied out, I would go into my room and just sit in my room and drink my beer. So as I said, I never knew why I was doing this ever. I just did it. And I developed this way that I acted, you know, to just act like I don't care what you do to me, or, you know, because, you know, I was so sensitive inside, and I was, you know, I was alcoholic. I mentioned my sister before. My sister celebrated 2 years of sobriety on May 21st, and I didn't know my sister had an alcohol problem. We don't live close to each other, and I don't see her that often. I see her more now in the last 2 years than I saw her before that. But my sister, I knew, had been going to group therapy for at least 15 years when I started, you know, when I was in AA. I knew that she wanted a new job and she wanted to get married. And so she was in group therapy for about 15 years talking about those things, neither one of which ever happened during her group therapy time. So I'm in AA now. And I've been married and divorced 3 times. And I just, you know, get new jobs, new careers, whatever. It's so exciting here, you know. You just get this courage to go out and do anything that you want to do. And so I used to try to talk. My sister used to call me up and tell me these things that were going on, not alcohol related, but the way she felt. And I remember telling her things that I had learned here, but she wasn't in AA and she didn't have to do what I said. Nobody has to do what I say, but you know, she didn't even consider following these suggestions. So, and she was full of fear, and I knew she felt the same way that we did. And one time I said, Kathleen, I know how you can get better. I want you to go out and drink, take drugs, whatever you need to do. I want you to make a mess of your life, and then you can come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything will be fine. But that was years and years ago. And so a little over 2 years, I had an email from my sister's boyfriend, and it said, Kathleen is drinking round the clock. She's not going to work. It's been going on for quite some time. I'm going to have to ask her to leave. Do you have any suggestions? And I just couldn't, I just stared at that email in disbelief. I had no idea. I mean, I should have known. Her six brothers and sisters and her father all have it, but I didn't. And I was glad. It's like, good. She's in very bad shape, you know. And so, I called her boyfriend, and he said she probably won't talk to you, and he told me when to try to call, and I tried calling, and she wouldn't talk to me, and I got a hold of him again. He said she was really mad at him for telling me. Well, my first instinct was to just get out to California. I live in Minnesota pretty much now, to get out to California and help her. But I've tried to do that before with people who don't really want help, and it just does not work. I've tried it before, and it just doesn't work. So I just sat back, and I prayed about it and just asked God to, you know, guide me. And so then I got this idea to write her a letter, one alcoholic to another alcoholic. And I wrote her a letter and sat down, and I just said, I know how you feel inside right now. I know exactly how you feel. And I proceeded to write how she felt. And I put an airplane ticket in the letter and said, if you want to come here, I'll help you. And I was hoping that this letter would make her cry, if she was ready, you know. And I sent it overnight, so the next day, right the minute she got it and read it, it worked. And she called me just sobbing, and I was so happy. And but so we started talking then, and it was probably a week or so after that, I don't know, that I went out to Los Angeles, and she was up in Northern California, and I had her meet me. And she had to take a train and then a bus to get to where I was. And I call that her bus ride to freedom now, because she called me every day and said, I don't think I can do this. And I wasn't quite sure that she could either, but I don't want to, I mean, I didn't want to run after her and go up there. I know that if any of us make an effort and do something like that for ourselves and for our sobriety, it's probably going to work. And so she said, I'm probably going to have to drink. And I said, go ahead and drink, just don't miss the train. And so she got off the bus that day, and she had been drinking. And I took her to a meeting that night, and she caught on fire with this thing. Now, I told you before, she wanted to get a new job. She was so close to finishing college years before, but she wouldn't finish. And one reason was that she didn't want to have to walk in front of a group of people to get her diploma. And she used to be so scared of those things, like we all are. So she's been sober 2 years. She married the guy. He had been her boyfriend for a long time. She graduated from college yesterday. And she's the secretary of a meeting, so she has to talk and give announcements. She called me the other day and left me a message. And she said, call me back as soon as you can. I have some really good news. Do you know what her good news was? She said, somebody asked me to sponsor them. And I know. And she was, I mean, this is just like, so why wouldn't I want to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous? Even though that's my sister, I have that kind of thing with many people in my life. I see people come in like all of us did, walk through those doors, and we are hopeless. And you can see it all over us, no matter how we're dressed. Or like that lady that my sponsor wanted me to talk to was so well-dressed and so pretty that in my mind there was nothing wrong with her. That was the kind of thing that I was jealous and envious of my whole life. I was talking to somebody before. She said that I looked nice, and, you know, I was getting dressed, and I thought, I like to get dressed up. I never got dressed up before, and I just made fun of people who got dressed up, women who dressed up. I didn't know how to dress up. I didn't know how to do makeup. I was very critical of myself. I didn't like the way I looked. And I like to look nice today, but before, like that woman, looked nice and was pretty, and I just thought she would not want to have anything to do with the likes of me. So, you know, it's not only, like we always hear, it's not only that we don't drink anymore. I mean, I just don't drink alcohol anymore, but it certainly has been a learning process. This is where I was born, really. I did not have a life before this. I kind of just wandered through life, and doing what I did, drinking, not drinking, but I had no clue about life at all. And we teach each other here how to do life. But part of my alcoholic behavior too, when I was, nowadays this is commonplace, but when I was 15 years old, it wasn't commonplace. I got pregnant and I didn't have a boyfriend for one thing, so that's not quite ordinary or common. If you've never been on a date in your life and you don't have a boyfriend and you turn up pregnant, it's kind of curious. But I did go to Catholic school, and they try to tell us about the Immaculate Conception, you know, so I'm like, but that part of my life, though, it's just simply because I was alcoholic. I used to hang out at a stable across the street from my house because I love the horses and I just love to be up there and hang out and ride the horses. And there was this guy up there. I was 15 years old. He was about 25 years old and he was just an absolute bum. He was a transient passing through town living up there in the shack. And he dared me to sneak out of my house in the middle of the night and come up to the stable. And I did anything that anybody dared me to do. I was, you know, I wanted attention. I wanted to show off for people. I wanted everybody to like me. So I snuck out of my house and went up to the stable, had sex for the first time in my life. I don't even think I knew I was having sex. I don't know what I thought. But anyway, whatever I had, it made me pregnant. And so, you know, I was in this Catholic school, and it wasn't a good deal. And my parents pretended they shipped me off to visit relatives for some unknown reason, and they sent me to live with a family, and I had this baby, and I gave it up for adoption, and then tried to go on with my life after that. But it was my alcoholic nature that made me do that kind of thing and other things like that. So I look back on that kind of person that I was and how I always felt inside, and I just thank God so much for Alcoholics Anonymous and for all of you for teaching me how to live my life, that I don't have to do things like that. It's not that I got sober and got good or perfect, which I sort of thought happened when I got here and I got sober and I wasn't doing everything just right. I thought I was the only one who was not. And it's not true. I mean, I'm not trying to give you a license to go do whatever, but I have to share my experience, strength, and hope. And speaking of that kind of deal, when I was probably 2 weeks sober, I was met at the door of my meeting by a guy who I look back on now. I call him a professional newcomer snatcher. And you know, here I am, this sick newcomer woman who doesn't, you know, just felt so bad about herself. And this guy is there, you know, telling me all these nice things. And so, you know, it worked, and I started seeing him. I had my husband at home, too, I might say. So, I mean, that's what I did. Luckily, I'm still sober, and I had a sponsor, and eventually I couldn't live like that. You know, after a while, I was sneaking around and seeing this guy. But I always went to my meetings. I always went to my meetings. I didn't skip meetings to go, you know, do whatever it was I was doing. I was kind of, I mean, we're all pretty nutty when we get in here. And I was just this wild, crazy newcomer girl and did things like that for a while. And Stephanie last night was talking about shoplifting before she got sober, and that helped her to get sober, and I shoplifted in my sobriety. And again, I don't know why it was kind of this exciting thing, I guess. You know, I didn't have anything else going on, so it's like, well, I think I'll shoplift now. And this other woman and I did it together, and then we would, like, run out to the car and compare who got the best things in the store. But, you know, I was sharing that one time in a meeting, and this woman asked me to sponsor her after that meeting. And I didn't know her before that time, and we were getting to know each other. And to me, she was, her character defects were really like being perfect. That was her character defect. So she, after we'd gotten to know each other a while, we were meeting at a woman's meeting, and she came in a little bit late, and I just thought she had to work late, and then she called me the next day and asked if I could have lunch with her. And I did, and she said, the reason I was late to the meeting last night is because I got caught shoplifting in Target. And I started applauding her, and I said, congratulations. Well, she was just so perfect, you know. And but she said the reason that she asked me to sponsor her is because I talked about shoplifting and she was doing her shoplifting. So I'm happy to report I don't shoplift anymore. And I have a husband and I don't have a boyfriend right now. So but anyway, where was I? So you know, I just really floundered through my life before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just was kind of like blowing with the wind, doing whatever. And I had gotten married the first time, and I had three little boys when I got sober. And my boys are close together. I have twin boys and then another son who's 2 years younger. And so trying to take care of these boys. Now, before, when I was doing my drinking, I could really just say, you know, everybody drinks like I do. And I hung around with people who did drink like I did. So, and my family certainly did. So I didn't have to stand out in the crowd. But now I'm home with these little boys. And I'm trying to take care of them, and I really could not take care of them. And every day it just seemed to get worse. I would try not to take a drink of alcohol every day. I'd say, I'd ask God, I'd pray to God, please don't let me drink today. I had a crucifix on my wall, and I used to stand there and pray and ask God, please, I don't want to drink. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I did not know this was a disease. I didn't know anything about it. I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous or anything. And so, you know, I barely ever go a day. My mind would say, well, you can just have one drink. For some reason, that's what I did for a long time. I said, you can just have one drink. And I would go get that one drink. And of course, for me anyway, it was then another one and another one and another one. The next day I would get up and I would say the same thing. I would try very hard not to take that drink. And then I would take just that one drink because. And I would have a reason why I could have one drink. So, this kind of thing pretty much went on day in and day out. My kids had some accidents that I'm very lucky that they survived, drinking charcoal lighter in the backyard because I couldn't take care. I wasn't watching them. And he had to go to the hospital and have his stomach pumped. I put the twin boys on I had this little motorcycle, a small motorcycle, and I put one on the front and one on the back in their diapers only because I could not control them. And I would ride them around the neighborhood on this motorcycle. And it got to the point where I would just lock the bedroom door. I put a lock on the outside of the door because I could not take care of them. I couldn't keep an eye on them. And I was getting toward the end of my drinking. I didn't know that, but I just knew that life was getting pretty difficult for me. And I locked them in their bedroom, and I would go in my backyard. There was a mountain in my backyard. I lived on this cul-de-sac, and so I would get my big bottle of wine. I bought wine a lot because that was what I could afford. And I would sit up on this mountain with this big bottle of wine, and I would just drink it out of the bottle, and my kids would be locked in the bedroom, and I would just be crying and thinking, the world is passing me by, and nobody understands me. And I didn't know then that I had the disease of alcoholism. I had no clue what was wrong with me. I believed that I should be locked up in a mental hospital, but I wasn't going to volunteer that. I actually did go. I lived by a state mental hospital out in California, and I used to drive over there all the time and sit at the end of the driveway hoping that somebody would come by and ask me why I was sitting at the end of the driveway and that they would talk to me and help me. And one night I put the boys in the car and I drove to a retreat center, Catholic retreat center, and I actually knocked on the door and I was going to ask a priest to help me, I guess, and nobody was there. I mean, a caretaker answered the door. But I just had no clue what was going on. So the day that I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I did not know that morning when I got up that I was going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous that night. It was a Sunday in January. We actually had people over to watch the Super Bowl. And I made Bloody Marys all day, and I stood by the punch bowl, and I made them their drinks, and I would drink, make a drink, and I would drink. I don't remember leaving the punch bowl that day, just drinking this all day long. And around 6 o'clock that night, a man, the last person that was at our house was a man, and he left by himself, and I walked out the door with him, and I got in his car, just goofing around, and he drove away, and he drove me somewhere else, to somebody's house or somewhere, and we had some more drinks. And I didn't normally just walk out the door and leave my family. And a couple hours later, I called my husband, and I asked him to come get me. And he got someone to watch the kids, and he was really mad at me. And he came and he got me. And for the first time, he said to me, "You would not do the things that you do. You would not act the way that you act if you didn't drink so much." We had never discussed my drinking. I knew that he marked all the bottles, and I made new marks on the bottles. I just turned them upside down and sideways, and then I filled them with water or did whatever. So, I mean, I knew he was kind of on to me, but we did not discuss this problem. And so that night he said that to me, and I didn't know what to do about it, and I knew that I could not quit drinking. I felt bad for my husband. I felt bad for my kids having me in their life. So I decided to leave them. That was my plan that night. He brought me back home. I picked up the phone and I called this old boyfriend of mine who I'd had in high school. But, you know, I don't know if any of you get obsessions over people. But, you know, I cannot see somebody, you know, for 10 years, but think about them every day and assume I can just call them and say, "Hi, it's me." You know, and so I called this guy up, this old boyfriend, and I asked him to come and get me. I didn't have a car. We had one car, and I didn't want to take the car. I just wanted to leave my husband and leave my kids and go live somewhere else by myself and leave them alone because I felt so hopeless. So I was talking to this guy on the phone, and my husband came in the room, and he said to me, "I don't care where you go, but you can't run away from it." And, you know, it must have been my time and my little surrender. Something happened inside of me. And I knew that if I went and moved somewhere else, that I would be there and nothing would be any different. And I hung up the phone and I called my then brother-in-law, who is a Catholic priest, and he lived in Pennsylvania. I was living in California. And I thought that he could pray for me. That was why I was calling him. I didn't know who else to call. He happened to be home, which was very unusual. And for the first time in my life, I said to another human being, "I cannot quit drinking." So I suppose that was my surrender, my step one. I'm powerless over alcohol. And my then brother-in-law told me to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He had been so he could see what it was like so he could help other people. And I was the first person that, you know, needed help. My husband got me in the car that night. Now, I went upstairs and he said, "We're going to this meeting." He got on the phone and found out where there was a meeting. I was a lot heavier than I am. I drank a lot of beer and wine. My hair was longer. I dyed my hair every other day. I didn't know what I was putting. I would just pour things on my hair. I didn't know what I was doing. I was bored. I was locked in the house with my kids most of the time, peeking out my drapes at the world. And And I went upstairs and I put on this orange polyester pantsuit that was in my closet. And it was a few sizes too small for me. And it zipped up the back. It had this little collar here. And this hair, my hair was, you would just touch it and it would break off. And this thing around my neck made my face redder than it already was. So, but I thought I looked nice because I wasn't wearing my cut-off jeans and my white t-shirt, which is what I preferred to wear most of the time. And so I thought that I looked nice. My husband got me in the car and we set off to go to this AA meeting that he found. Now, driving there, I started thinking, and I said, what are these people going to do? Chain me up, stay with me all the time. I cannot quit drinking. And I said, let's go home. I'll go tomorrow. And he started driving faster because I said I was going to jump out of the car. And he started driving fast, so hopefully I wouldn't jump out of the car if he was going too fast. So we finally got to this AA meeting out in California. And it was about 5 minutes before the meeting ended. We walked in the back door. There were folding chairs set up. There were probably 30 people in this meeting. A man was speaking. We came in and I sat on the aisle. And the minute that meeting was over, I swear that every person in that room came to me, sitting right about where the lady in the black shirt is sitting, right back there. They could tell that I was a newcomer. For a long time, I couldn't figure out why did they all come over to me. Plus, I was drunk. Plus, then when they came around me, I started throwing up on the floor. So if they didn't know already, now they really know. But they did know, and they all came to me, and these people had cake. Somebody said, here's coffee, here's cake, here's literature, here's my phone number. And that's when I just stood there, and then I started throwing up. And I ran out the door. And then they all came out the door. They all came outside. They all wanted to stand out in the parking lot and watch me throw up and sing and dance. It seems to me later that they were holding hands, singing, dancing, laughing, you know. And in a way, I mean, it's true. We love newcomers, especially that kind of newcomer, you know. So that was my beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was 26 years old when I got sober. And in 1971, when I came in, that was very young. There were not that many younger people in AA at the time. But so that night, these ladies wanted me to stay there and talk with them, and they were in their 50s, for heaven's sakes. And they said, you know, we'll talk to you and we'll take you home. And I would not. I was holding on to my husband's leg like I was a 2-year-old kid. And I would not stay with those ladies. I didn't know what was going to happen to me now. So I went home. And I was just sitting in my living room the next day staring at the wall. And the ladies came to my door. I guess my husband told them where we lived. And, but, you know, I really didn't want to drink anymore. And I didn't know that I could, you know, go without alcohol, because I had certainly tried. I'd been hospitalized with different things, and I got hospitalized with pancreatitis after I quit drinking. I think my body just didn't like this. Hey, where's all that alcohol you've been giving me? I'm going to act up now. So, I'd been in the hospital for different reasons. Mysterious things would happen to me, and I'd be in the hospital, and I'd be in there for 5 or 6 days, and I would always think, see, I haven't had alcohol for 5 days, so I don't have a problem with alcohol. But I was getting, you know, all this pain stuff all the time. So, but anyway, I did want to not drink anymore, but I did not think that I could. So I was sitting there, and these ladies came in the next day, and they sat in my living room, and they talked with me. And I think I said in the beginning, too, I mean, it was one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. I never saw those ladies before the night before, you know, when I met them at the meeting, barely met them, drunk and throwing up, and they just touched my heart. I felt like I had known them all my life. We were talking today, some of us, about going anywhere in the world And we are so lucky. I can go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting anywhere in the world and walk in and feel like I've known those people my whole life. And so those ladies talked with me, and that was the beginning for me. That was in January of 71, and I told you before, my sobriety date's May 23rd, 1971. I wanted to be sober. I went to meetings during that time. I didn't get a sponsor because I didn't know how to get a sponsor. I'm sure I was told, and I'm sure people were nice to me, and a lot of women gave me their numbers. And I would sit in my kitchen, I remember, with that phone number, thinking, now what am I supposed to say to this lady when I call her? And I thought so little of myself that I thought then she would ask me to describe myself, and then I would have to say I'm the fat, ugly, orange person that was at the meeting. I mean, I really had no identity anyway. And I had no idea what I was going to talk to anybody about. And also, I had this feeling, and I had it all my life, and I realized it after I quit drinking, you know, that if I thought that if I called this lady, and when she realized who it was, inside she would think, oh, it's her. That's how I felt. Like, no, people didn't want me around. If they saw me coming, they'd go the other way, just because of how I felt about myself inside. So that began my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I drank in May, I went right back. I really wanted to be sober. And so luckily I went to a meeting, and the next day, and a lady came up to me and she said, let me be your interim sponsor. And I was so grateful to her for doing that, because I'm scared. And it really made me mad that I was afraid. Because I told you before, I really used alcohol my whole life, and I never knew I was afraid. So now I'm sober. And having five brothers, you know, my thing was to beat people up. I had to fight with them all the time. So my thing was to swear, use a lot of profanity, and beat people up. And so doing that, I didn't think I was afraid. I had no idea that I was so afraid inside and afraid of people and so self-conscious, you know, self-obsessed. And I was so glad that this woman came up and offered to be my sponsor. I don't like rejection. To this day, I don't like it. I mean, I can deal with it, and I can, you know, not let that keep me from doing something anymore. But I didn't want to ask anybody because they probably didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be a burden. And I didn't want to ask anybody in case they would say, no, I can't sponsor you. And so I have to remember that lady. And I told you before, I have the same feelings inside that I've always had. And so, I mean, I can pretty much look at the newcomers and I remember and I can identify with how they feel. So I always try to remember that and go to the newcomers and give them my phone number and not just sit home and wait for them to call me. I'll call the first time or the first two times. I want to try to make people feel welcome, and I'll go get them and bring them to the meeting because I know how scary it is for us to do that. And I got involved in this very active group in California that pretty tough, you know, you sponsorship, and you go to meetings every night. And I used to say, but I have these kids and this husband, and they would just look at me like, so? And you go to the meeting every night. You drank every day. I used to think, God, that's stupid. I wish they'd stop saying that to me. But I went to meetings every night. And, you know, it was the first place in my whole life that I ever wanted to go all the time and felt like I fit in, and I was excited to go and talk to people there and listen to speakers. I just used to love speaker meetings, and we had a lot of them out there, and I loved to go to speaker meetings. But that began my journey here in Alcoholics Anonymous and in life, really. And my life has been exciting, I think, far more exciting in my sobriety than it was drinking, really. I never thought it would be like that, but as far as I'm concerned, it is. And statistically speaking, you know, I am married to my third husband now, my current husband, Ed. He's a very nice man. We do get along well, and we live in two different states, but we get along well anyway. So my three boys are doing okay. You know, they have, one of my boys was getting in some trouble, and I was sober at AA, and I had to go to court and sit there with him. And he received a sentence, you know. And it really broke my heart. This was one of the turning points, though, that helped me to accept the fact that my mother did the very best she could raising us. Because when my son had to go to jail, you know, I thought, this is not the way I planned it. And I did not ever think this would happen. And it just kind of put it all together for me. And it was like, I was around 12 years sober when that happened. Something just clicked inside me for the very first time, because I had a lot of resentments against my mother up until that time. But it just kind of clicked. You know what? She did the very best she can. And it was one of the new freedoms that I felt here. So, but I had to, when I heard my son receive a sentence and had to go to jail, I said the Serenity Prayer immediately, and it worked. And you know, he's okay today, and they're just living life and experiencing things like we all do. And my youngest son lives in Minnesota. My other two sons live in California. And so 2.5 years ago, my youngest son became a father for the first time, and I was able to be there. And I watched the doctor pull that baby out, and I watched my son cut the cord, and I've been a part of Jack's life since that time. And just a few days before I came here, my son Joe and my grandson Jack and I were in the park, hanging out, eating lunch, having a picnic. Jack fell in a pond, and I jumped in and rescued him. And he's 2.5 years old. He's the same age that my boys were when I got sober. I think the twins were 3 and Joe was a year old. And it's such a joy to me. You know, and it's so funny, I still have this thing inside, like, I wonder if they'll let me take Jack for the day, like I'm not trustworthy or something. You know, it's so ingrained in me. And I drove drunk with my 3 boys in the car. Many times I did that. So it's really a joy and a blessing for me to be able to spend time with him. But let's see, I had this feeling for many years here that I'll never do anything. I'll never get a good job. I'll never make money. It's a big pity party that I was in for a long time. And that was because I got divorced when I was 3 years sober. And I wanted to get divorced when I was 2 days sober. And my husband really is a very nice man. But I just didn't want to be married. And my sponsor told me to not make any major changes the first year of my sobriety. And I told you before I started seeing that guy. So I had my husband and this guy. But I did stop seeing the guy. And she explained to me how I had to do the very best that I could in that marriage and try to do things right so that if the time did come and we split up, that I could feel good about myself. And so I did follow sponsor direction pretty much, but I think as Stephanie said last night, I didn't always tell my sponsor everything either. But I stayed in that marriage for, 3 years just trying to do the right thing. And being newly sober is just, it's an adventure in itself. And so Joe and I got divorced, and I had to find a job, and this is when I just started thinking, I have no education. I barely made it through high school. I had the baby. I went back and finished high school. I never studied. I never learned anything. I was more interested in acting up and drawing attention to myself and getting in trouble, and I barely made it through. I just didn't learn anything. I became a dental assistant after I got out of high school because it was just there. It was something to do. And by the way, when I worked in that before sobriety, I did something that I didn't give it a name until I got here. It was called embezzling. But I just said, I need this money, and I do a lot of work here, and he doesn't pay me enough money, and I deserve more money, but I wouldn't ask him for more money, and I was the bookkeeper and everything, and so I just justified the whole thing. But after I was sober a while, I'm like, I think that was called embezzling. And I also just took handfuls of pills when I worked in that office, pain pills. I prefer alcohol, but one of my jobs was standing over people with that vacuum, like sucking the water out of their mouth. And I didn't want to smell like alcohol. I never wanted anybody to know that I was drinking. So I just took handfuls of pills when I worked there. But anyway, that was it. So I'm sober now, and I've got to get a job, and I got a job as a dental assistant. And I spend a lot of time thinking I'll never do anything else. I have no education. I have no skills. And I've got these three kids now, and I'm just stuck. You know, my life is going to be a big struggle. That's what I thought it was going to be. And I could barely make ends meet ever. And I really couldn't. I mean, I hid from the landlord 1 month and hid from the daycare people and, you know, just tried to get by. But because then I thought, well, I'm going to try to go to school. And I was a single parent then, and I thought I would take some classes. But every time I would start to, you know, take a class, well, I thought, I can't go to work, I can't take care of these kids, I can't go to meetings and go to school and do my AA. AA was very important to me, and I'd been given some good advice in the beginning to make it the most important thing in my life for a while, a priority. And so I would drop out. I had to get these transcripts recently after all these years, and there were so many withdrawals, I had no idea. But I kept trying, and then it just didn't work out. But I have to tell you that for me, it worked out that if I just came to my AA meetings, came up to the podium when I was asked to, because I never wanted to do this. I used to hide. I used to sit behind the pillar. I used to shake. It's like, I can't do that. We had a lot of call-up meetings. But in my group, you had to do it. And they wouldn't let you sit there and say, no thanks, I pass. And, you know, they just made you get up there. And I always had commitments at meetings. And I started working with people. And by doing that kind of stuff for me, gave me whatever it is I needed inside, confidence, self-worth, and things like that, so that I was able to go out in the world and get different, better jobs and make more money. And that's how it worked for me. I mean, I job-wise, I've just kind of, you know, one day a woman I sponsored was going to become a flight attendant, and I kind of got in the car with her and went on the interview, and I got hired too. And it's like, well, that's fun. That'll be nice. And but I remember a time in my sobriety when I was really wanting to do something different and I just needed to make more money, and I didn't know how I was going to do that. Now, by this time, I'm learning. I mean, I pray, I ask God to show me your will for me, and that's a whole deal in itself, because it was hard for me, and I think for all of us, like, what does that mean? Because, you know, I could turn my life and my will over to God. I'm doing it while I'm kneeling down saying those words, but then I go out into the world and I'm doing my own will. And it was just a hard concept to get, but I kept working at it and practicing at it. So now I'm at this point where every day I'm saying, God, you know, show me what to do. I don't know. I think, you know, I'd like to do something else and make more money and whatever. And I'd ask God for help. And then I'd go to my meetings, and I would tell people, I need to get some new career, new job. And people started saying, well, why don't you get into sales? And I would say, no, I don't really want to be in sales. I don't really think I'd like that. Then I'd go talk to somebody else, tell them the same thing. They'd say, well, why don't you get into sales? No, I don't think so. I don't think that's a good deal. And, I mean, really, I'd go to 3 or 4 or 5 people. But I think I realized one day, okay, 8 people have told me the same thing. And I'm asking God to help me. Maybe I better listen, you know. I think I'm getting my answer. So I did get into sales, and I had different sales jobs over the years, outside sales, and I don't like rejection. So in most of my jobs, I had to walk in and out of offices, you know, and talk to people. But anyway, I did that, and I made a lot more money. I won a trip to Monte Carlo. And that was another thing, too. I was born in California, and up to that point, I'd never been out of California. And I said, I'm never going to go anywhere. It wasn't only that I wasn't going to ever have any money, ever have a good job. I wasn't ever going to go anywhere either. And so, you know, I won this great trip to Monte Carlo, and I went to Paris, and I went to Rome, and I am a flight attendant now, and I, last week I was in Amsterdam two different times, and I went to, I've been to Singapore, and I rode camels in Cairo, and it's like, you know, it's kind of funny to look back on myself at that time, you know, thinking I'll never go anywhere. It's like, okay, uncle, I'm going too many places now. This is enough. But so I want to tell you about the first time that I think I really felt or got a concept of God. Quite honestly, I was about 4 years sober. I mean, I really tried before that time. I worked at it. I got on my knees. I said what people told me to say, but I really didn't quite get it. And after Joe and I got divorced, I think I tried to date, which is just death for us. It's just, you know, horrible. I think I had a boyfriend or something, and we broke up, and I mean, that's just suicidal time for me. I mean, and part of it was because I had no God either. And I felt the worst I'd felt in my sobriety. I felt this feeling of emptiness and loneliness that I had never felt before at around 4 years of sobriety. And I was in this really terrible emotional pain. I mean, thinking it's over the guy, but, you know, I mean, there's more to it than that. But I was in this terrible emotional pain and just real scared again. I went to my meetings again. I mean, I just go to my meetings. But I would sit in the closet in my house. I would just be so scared and feeling so fragile and just so, like, don't hurt me. And I would sit in a closet, and then I'd kind of like, oh, I better go to my AA meeting now. And I'd get out of the closet and go to my meeting. But I used to get on my knees every night and ask God to help me. But what I was saying then was, please help me. I hurt so much. Please help me to stop hurting so much. And things like that. And it went on day in and day out for months. I just had this, I just hurt. And after a while, I would be on my knees kneeling at my bed, and I would think, I don't get this. I'm praying to a bedspread. That's what I felt like. I was just praying to that bedspread. I didn't get it. Well, after that, I don't know the time frame exactly, but one day it just came to me that indeed there is a God who is watching over me, because I cannot live through that kind of emotional pain. And I have lessons to learn. And if God wasn't watching over me and taking care of me and loving me, I would have had to drink through that. But I didn't have to drink. I didn't have to be medicated. I didn't have to be hospitalized. I went to AA meetings. And for that period of time, I would feel better. But it was that day I realized that there is a God in my life, and that God is there for me and is going to walk me through these things. We're all going to have things that we need help with. I myself have had things, and I sponsor people. I sponsor a woman who lost her baby at delivery because of a cord accident. And you know what? She survived it. It was her first baby, and she survived it. And she said the love and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous is what got her through that kind of a thing. Because we just showed up. We know how to do that. We just show up at people's houses. Even if we sit and cry with them, we just show up. But so that was the first time for me that I felt this, any real concept of God. And so that emptiness and that loneliness that I had during that time really was gone. And I don't believe it's ever been, you know, that bad since. So that was really my first experience of really like, that's it. And my concept now of turning my life and my will over to God, it's taken practice, but over the years, what I do now is I get up and I say my prayers and I do some meditation, but I just simply say, God, I turn my life and my will over to you. And I go on about my day. And I don't really have to think about it any more than that. Because I just accept that really whatever I'm doing is God's will. It's pretty simple. And when I used to try to figure it out, okay, now, is it God's will that I do this or call that person or, you know, steal that sweater or answer the phone or whatever, then it always ended up to be my will because I'm trying to figure it out. And I don't have to figure it out anymore. It's pretty simple. But so life is, you know, it's just really exciting. A couple months ago in April, well, I told you I've done different jobs and just different things. One time my husband dared me to do stand-up comedy, and so I had to do it for a while. And I mean, I did it for about 4 years. And I used to think, why? I mean, this is like for a person that's so sensitive and hates rejection. Why am I doing this? Do I just like to torture myself so? But he dared me to do it, so I did that, and then I got this job. Now I've been with this airline for 5 years, and so I couldn't do it. I had to work a lot of weekends, but I always wanted to do that kind of thing again. So I can get weekends off now pretty easily. So I've been thinking of doing that again or doing something as far as performing. And I was sitting in my women's meeting last fall, and it just, this is what I mean about, I mean, it's not like God cares if I do it or not, but it's just like I can tune myself into, you know, things. I mean, I just feel if I'm trying to do God's will and I'm praying and meditating and just trying to, you know, live my spiritual life, that I can be open to ideas and things that I get. So I was sitting in the meeting and I just looked around and there were these three women in there. One I sponsor, and these two other women, two of them did acting at the time, one of them did writing, and it just came to me, and I thought, the four of us should do a show together. Wouldn't that be fun, a comedy show? And so right after the meeting, I went to them, and I asked them to talk, you know, if they talked to me, and I asked them if they wanted to get together and do a show, and we would plan it, and they said, sure. So we started meeting like the next week, and I said, you know, we won't do this if we just say we're going to do it sometime. And I said, we need to go ahead and rent a theater and make the commitment, because that's how I've learned to do things here. It's like my fear will keep me from doing things, and I don't ever want to have the day come in my life where I have regrets that I didn't do something because of fear. So they said, yeah, that's right, we need to rent a theater. So we set out to find one, and we rented one, and we signed a contract. And the next 2 days, we were all calling each other saying, what did we just do? Why did we do that? What got into our minds? Why do we think we can do this? But you know what? We made the commitment, and that was in the fall, and so we rented it for April, the first 2 weekends in April, which just passed. And so we got together, you know, a couple times a week and did writing and brought things. And it was really scary. It was a very scary process, and becoming vulnerable and me writing stuff and saying, this is what I'm thinking of doing. My confidence level, you know, just wants to go up and down, especially when I'm doing something new and something so scary. But the thing is, anyway, we did it, and we worked really hard on the show, and we, being alcoholics, we're nice perfectionists, you know, and we're like rewriting things up to the last minute. But anyway, we did it, and it's a small theater. It holds 80 people, but they sold out. I mean, they had to open up selling of the tickets before they normally do for the show that's in April. And they were calling us and saying, what's up? You know, we get so many calls for people that want to come to your show. Well, it was everybody in AA. And then it occurred to me, it's a dinner, they serve food and alcohol there too. And then it occurred to me, they might catch on, because I don't think they're going to serve too much alcohol at our shows. But you know what? We sold out way before, you know, we did the shows. All four shows were sold out. The opening night, it was so exciting. It was just all I mean, it was everybody in our group was there, and they were just yelling and screaming and carrying on, and it was just absolutely the best. And this one girl, one of the women, one of her deals in the show was that she's very big, she's very tall, she's heavy, and she started this thing of saying, you know, I think bigger women should have role models too, not just Britney Spears types. And so she was Britney Spears. She wore this tiny little red vinyl little pants way down here and this tiny little top and her great big belly hanging out. And we were her backup singers in these skimpy little clothes. And we just had a ball. We had the best time. And you know, it was, we're doing it again in July. You know what? And it's like, I didn't know those women. I was lonely when I came here, I was so lonely. I never really had good friends in my life. I was always afraid. I was always, you know, looking around the corner. What's everybody doing? What's everybody talking about? I just don't get it. And you know, I'm here now and I get it. And I can, you know, live this new life and do fun things like that and have all these wonderful people in my life, these people I sponsor and watch them, you know, just whatever it is they're doing in their life, I can be a part of it and be with my grandson and be with you. And it's a wonderful life. Thank you so much again for inviting me here this weekend.